It's ad break time. I'm proud to announce that Beyond Solitaire podcast is sponsored by Central Michigan University's Center for Learning Through Games and Simulations. And as usual, they're up to some amazing things. Their next game, Hydrologic Cycle, is scheduled to come to Kickstarter on March 26th. CLGS also continues to offer classes in partnership with Gen Con. The next course, Jason Fury's Crowdfunding with Confidence, starts May 6th and will teach you all about board games and crowdfunding. Go check it out. Also, I'll include a final plug for myself. If you like the show and want to support it, you can do so by going to patreon.com/beyondsolitaire. Thanks to listeners like you, I've been able to keep upgrading my equipment, subscribing to StreamYard, and more. But for now, let's get on with the show. Hey, gamers, this is Liz Davidson from Beyond Solitaire, and this week at the pod, I'm a very special guest. This is Dr. Ali Kojo-Williams. He is professor of history at Clarkson in New York.
In Northern New York, yes.
Northern New York. Is it cold up there right now?
It's actually really unseasonably warm and sunny right now, but it's normally cold up here this time of year.
I mean, I just live in Georgia, so I have to live vicariously through other people's cold. But why don't you tell us the basics of the kind of history you do, and then I want to talk about your class, which involves lots of board games.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on. Exciting to be here. So I am actually, by background, I am a historian of late Russian imperial and early Soviet foreign policy. And so that's, you know, that's what I do, and that's what I ostensibly write books about. And, you know, still try to write books about and think about. There's, you know, there's challenges in that space at the moment as a result of archival access. But I teach at Clarkson University, all the way in Northern New York, almost Canada, actually. So I'm actually really close to McGill and Rex Brynan. And way back in the midst of time now, before the pandemic, I had an idea. Because I was teaching classes that had war in the title. And I taught for many, many years things that intersected through sort of a war and society course that was fairly general. It took a kind of a gateway into our war studies minor. And then we had a course that I was, you know, going to put on World War II. And I kind of had the idea as I was sort of figuring through this that I was at a point where I could do something a little bit experimental and a little bit different with that, and said to my students, you know, hey, what about, would you be interested in playing tabletop games in a course? And they were all just sort of look at me like, first of all, are you crazy? And yes. And I guess, you know, it was just kind of this sort of great moment of being able to do something a bit different. I was, you know, not having to worry about a tenure clock, which is kind of an important factor, I think, of being able to experiment. But also, I guess, at a point that there were kind of lots of games that were sort of appearing that I thought I could do stuff with. And that were relatively accessible. And so I put together for my spring 2020 class, and spring 2020 was a weird time. I had no idea what was coming when I started this in late January, with kind of just a handful of games, and, you know, really decided that what I was going to pitch to students was that I was going to give them a set of lenses through which to start to look at how they could interpret and understand certain aspects of World War II, and that set of lenses was going to be a set of games that dealt with things in different ways and would take them down alleys I couldn't take them down in class because there wasn't space or time, or I simply don't have that granular amount of detail on the Battle of the Bulge that I could pass to them. And so that was kind of the exciting pitch. And the kicker was, but they had to also design something. They needed to come up with a loose prototype by the end of the semester that communicated an aspect of World War II to a non-academic audience. And I was able to hang this quite neatly institutionally on sort of the entrepreneurial angle, which worked out really nicely for me because somebody then gave me a chunk of money, which was nice because that took me into the Moore's Certificate in Wargaming class, where that was online, so I didn't meet lots of people, but it was, you know, I met sort of diverse people and I encountered Sebastian Bay there, who I know I've said this to on Twitter to Sebastian, and he kind of thinks, you know, every time he's like, this is crazy to me, but Sebastian became a big inspiration in kind of where I went, and I was able to kind of run with the idea with funding to build a library, some of which you can see behind me on camera, if the students can come and play and other faculty can borrow. and really develop this into teaching other courses. And I took it then in spring 2021 into teaching World War One, which is what I'm also teaching right now in 2024, and then pushed it into the direction of the Cold War. And all the time as I was sort of building some of this and getting students used to playing games and thinking about them, and they're coming up with little ideas, what I had sort of developing in the background was ultimately a course in wargaming, which I was able to float last fall. And I taught 30 students, probably looked fairly similar to the sort of things that Rex Brynan does at McGill, that Sebastian Bay does down at Georgetown. Probably intersects in various places with sort of things Morris Suckling does as well, down at RPI. But I had this 14-week course in wargaming, where the sort of key thrust was, how can we use war games or historical games? Because a little fluid on where a war game sits sometimes, big question there, to understand, interpret, and represent history, and how can we communicate things and develop things, and lots of design decisions, and sort of built that. So I guess I kind of, you know, it's a big snowball that is sort of built over the past, I guess 3 to 4 years. And as part of my wargaming course in the fall, I managed to get a host of really great guest speakers in who came and spoke to my students and fleshed out things from all sorts of different angles, and had, you know, they're kind of household names in the wargaming hobby. And so it was lots of fun. And I think, you know, I get great feedback. My students love this. They love the creative outlet. They like playing the games, even though when they come into my classroom, they're often very not big gamers. They seem to leave it, playing lots of games.
Oh, that's awesome. So actually, I have a couple questions that have sprung from all of this. So the first one is, when you're doing historically targeted classes that have games involved, so gaming World War II, World War I, Cold War, how do you select for games that are the right combination of historically meaty enough to talk about in class and also rules light enough for students to learn?
That's a really good question. I guess part of the decision is led to some extent by availability and by price. Being able to get multiple copies of things is kind of a really big plus, and being able to play things sort of alongside. The question about rules light and learnable. Students really like big boxes of things, and they get particularly attracted to things that they think might be familiar. They really like little plastic men, so they love the idea of Axis and Allies until they try to set it up, and then discover that actually they didn't want to spend that much time setting it up. The rules light. I mean, part of what I try to do is teach a game as much as anything else. And lead them through, I guess, kind of what are gateway games that take them in certain directions. So when I teach World War II, I bring them through Battle for Moscow quite early on, and it has that great online version, so they don't have to worry about setting it up, which gets them into, this is how a hex encounter game kind of works. And then that then lets them sort of spin into things that are a bit bigger. I do find that students, they quite often, they get attracted by all the chrome and by the shiny boxes. And my students do refer to sometimes what they refer to as GMT games, where they sort of anticipate a degree of complexity that is going on. But it is a fine line between getting them into things that are meaty and getting them into things that they can learn. There are some brilliant games out there, to expose them to. And so, you know, I put Undaunted Normandy in front of them, fairly early on. I say, look, here's an approach, and this is, you know, different to some of the other things. In World War One, I have them play the Grizzled pretty early on, so that they're getting into use of things. They often discover that rule books are a challenge, and they struggle a bit. I guess there's a host of YouTube content. I point them at things like Watch It Played and The Player's Aid and Aardwolf, and you know, there's all these things out there. Sometimes I get reports back from them. I make them write after action reports, and they say this was so complicated. We spent so much time trying to figure it out that we didn't get very far with it, but we can still see what it was trying to teach us. And I guess, you know, a lot of what I try to communicate to students with games is that the journey is as educational as the outcome, in terms of playing a game and unpicking it and dissecting it and figuring out, you know, what worked for them, what didn't, what was the designer trying to do, what's it trying to communicate, do they really need to win even if they want to win? And one of the problems if they do win is the wrong side. And so, yeah, there's a lot of balance there, and lots of people have ideas about, you know, what sort of ways in look like. You know, the worst thing you can do, I guess, is throw something so complicated that someone is immediately turned off. The other thing I found, though, is using students who have taken now a number of my courses and have become quite experienced gamers, sort of as the seed players, to kind of what Cole Worley talks about is, you know, doing the teach. And I actually have a couple of students now who seem to be running around campus teaching everyone how to play Root at the moment because they want more people to play against.
Oh, that's excellent. So when you ask for kind of after action reports, what kinds of things do you ask your students to reflect on? And then I'm assuming that they're also reading primary documents and source material. So what kind of expectations do you have in terms of, like, I guess, the academic engagement that they're going to have with that game when they write about it after play?
So I try to keep them, you know, a bit short and pithy so that we don't get into the, you know, the 42-page report that no one wants to read. But I, you know, really try and get them to focus on what is the game trying to communicate? You know, what is it about, and what is it trying to communicate about its subject matter? And how well does it do that for them and the group that they play with? And you know, to a sort of lesser extent, then what happens? What's their takeaway? I often try and sort of put it to them as, you know, if one were to think about, you know, a game as a book or as an article or sort of a primary source, you know, what is this saying? What is this contributing to our discussion? And you know, what's the argument that the game is making? You know, every game I try to explain to students is making a statement about something. Even if you don't necessarily agree with the statement, it's trying to tell you something. And where would they, you know, where might they take it, or where is it taking them? What ideas do they take away from it? And how does it, and again, to think about, you know, how does it mesh with what we're talking about in class, what they're seeing in primary and secondary source material. And actually I find it's kind of, it ends up being slightly sneaky, because if they get really excited about something, they go off and read a whole lot more because they want to be able to actually sort of, you know, situate the game within a discussion. So they want to say, well, you know, there's ever any number of games on the D-Day landings, but what is this one actually saying, and where is it sitting here, and how is this different to what I thought I know from watching Saving Private Ryan and Band of Brothers, or reading things or looking at maps?
So when you introduce games to your students, do you select for historical accuracy or poignancy, or do you just let them try a bunch of different stuff and come to their own conclusions about a game's meaning and the quality of its expression?
So I kind of let them take that step for themselves. So I have this sort of fairly famous on Twitter cart that I wheel around and people look at and take photographs. And the cart does change. Sort of shifts around, so a lot of the what's on the card at a given point, and that, you know, it functions as a part of my library for students to take stuff away and play, or playing stuff in class. So it does change depending on what I'm teaching in a given, you know, week or day, in trying to get them to think about things. But I try to get them to come at the, you know, games as sources relatively unconstrained, without me telling them what I think they should think about it. And I think this is kind of, you know, much the what I would suggest, you know, point to them in class. I might tell them that a certain game talks about something or does something in much the same way that I would talk about a book written by a historian, telling them something. But I am always wary that, you know, I don't wish to color their perception by putting myself in that frame, because, you know, I'm significantly older than the majority of my students, and I've been doing this for a while, and I've played a lot more games than they have. And you know, I don't want to steer them in certain ways that might actually lead them to miss something really important. because you know, Kocho said this, and then they play it. I tend to, though, you know, students will say, well, what would you recommend? I try to get them to focus on subject matter that interests them so that they're engaged, but also to look at a range of different approaches to not just a subject, but also to gameplay. So there's kind of a world of difference between piling lots of counters in a hex to playing something that is looser, or that has more of a narrative component to it, and a difference between something which is, you know, multi-headed, set against sometimes playing solitaire games, and how they might think about that and pick through that.
So you also mentioned that, you know, you get funding to buy a lot of these games. Are the games students are playing games that are supplied by you, or are they games that students acquire themselves, or, you know, how does that tend to work given the desire to give students freedom to choose?
So I tell students that they can bring their own games into the mix if they want. They might have things they already own, or they might have things that they particularly want that I don't have access to because it doesn't sit within my collection. I am mindful in the kind of purchasing space, you know, of teaching college courses, that nothing you ask students to acquire as course materials should be more expensive than a textbook that they're going to use throughout the whole of a semester. And I think that's come up with, there was a study with someone who was teaching World War II, and it was in the American Historical Association's magazine, of a sort of similar approach, is that, you know, this is a textbook. So there's kind of a ceiling there where, given the price of textbooks, your mileage may vary, but you might manage to get hold of a GMT or a Compass Games a copy for the same price of a textbook, or you might not. You might buy, you know, Undaunted Normandy for as a relatively inexpensive, but that doesn't necessarily give them a semester's worth of material to play with. So I was, you know, fortunate. Someone gave me a chunk of money, and people have donated games as well, publishers, and indeed actually have an enthusiastic alumni supporter who sends me things on occasion as well. I'm very grateful to them as a means of building a fairly sizable library. I've got about 300 titles in it. I have not played them all myself, I will be very honest, but because that's what we do in gaming, right? We talk about games and deconstruct them, but we don't necessarily get around to it. And we think about, you know, what would be good. I guess it's a curated collection that is designed to give them a mixture of range, but also focus within that range. So I have, you know, quite a lot of things, but, you know, a lot of there's a limited number of publishers. And a limited number of designs, and anything particularly old is either out of print or is challenging. Students do sort of, they get themselves attracted. They like big, deep boxes. So things that are, they don't like folios, because I guess this doesn't look like a boxed board game to them. And when they come into the space, many of them have never played a war game when I first get my hands on them. So I, you know, they are a little limited by what I have, but I have rather a lot. My wife jokes about the fact I just have too many games. My daughter actually made me a Christmas present that was a small box of yet another war game on the same subject with nothing in. So it's become a bit of a running joke within my family. But yeah, I mean, I don't expect students to necessarily be able to lay hands on these things themselves, particularly in Northern New York, because we lack a sort of certain population density. So they can't pop down to, you know, Labyrinth Games or something on a Tuesday evening and find a whole bunch of people who've got things out on the table. We don't have a, you know, friendly local game store up here. So the game library is largely what sits in my office, as an institutional collection.
Have you incorporated digital implementations at all? I know there are a lot of Vassal modules out there, et cetera. Is that something that, you know, is brought into your classes as a possible resource, or do you try to keep it analog?
So it's out there, and I give them lots of resources, and I tell them about it. And a couple of them have played a few things on Vassal. A couple of them have played a couple of things that have been, you know, released in digital platforms. So Twilight Struggle gets a lot of digital play. Some of them play the digital version of Root. Quite a lot of them this semester are playing Backstabber as a way of playing diplomacy online. And increasingly, I try to point them at things like Rally the Troops because there's some really good implementations there. Oddly, although I teach at a technological university, my students are really reticent to actually step over into that digital space. And you know, they like some of the convenience of it. I do use, you know, Battle for Moscow digitally, but they tell me they really just like the analog experience of a game. And I think part of it is they don't want to learn how to use another platform, because you know, Vassal is a little clumsy. Rally the Troops is a lot better. Tabletop Simulator is much better. But they seem to really like the outlet of touching things with their hands and moving things around and being able to think and the social interactive side. So actually most of them, even though they could go the digital route with it, are all playing things in, you know, in person, you know, on tabletops.
I like it. I like it. I know you don't want to play favorites, but if your collection were to disappear today, which games would you buy first to replace it?
Oh wow, that's really hard, and I don't know who might be listening who's gonna potentially take
Well, I
offense.
mean, it's not about what's best, right? It's about like what are the easy favorites, the ones that students are picking up the most naturally.
Yeah,
What are your hits?
so the biggest hit that I have has to be Root. Students, you know, once they get into the fact that these cute little woodland creatures are actually hiding a really serious game underneath, they absolutely love it. And I have several copies of it. And actually it was very nice. Cole actually came and spoke to my wargaming class last fall. So they got very excited. And I think, you know, Root is that nice mix of accessibility, theme, and complexity that keeps giving back. As well, and so students have a lot of fun, and obviously the expansions take them into different directions. So I think, you know, that's sort of a firm favorite of students, and you know, I have a great love for it myself. I think a lot of, you know, what I see, you know, is students really gravitating towards subjects that they kind of really like. So, you know, they often find that they sort of chew through things. So I think I would keep up some of the kind of the gateway games, the Memoir 44s, you know, Undaunted Normandies of the world. And then kind of where that, I guess, takes them as to what I would have to look at my list as to what gets checked out really regularly. This semester, there's been a lot of play of Verdun Steel Inferno. That's been a really big hit with students in playing through that. When I've taught World War II in the recent past, the sort of, you know, the game that keeps moving around is Churchill. They get really into doing the peacemaking. I haven't yet hit that point in my World War I course this semester with Versailles 1919. But I guess sort of on, you know, personal levels, I sort of focus on, you know, the things that are big favorites for me are the things that kind of speak to me and engage in the spaces where my own work sort of is situated. So I like things that deal with the former Soviet space and Russia. I'm not so sure that I'm necessarily, you know, that much of an Eastern Front gamer, but I like the political space. So, you know, Triumph and Tragedy is a, you know, big favorite of mine, in terms of being able to sort of think about how you posit things. You know, I wish I had more time sometimes for things, you know, it's a, kind of, you know, some of these things that move through. I love Versailles 1919. I think that's a great, you know, I guess a peace game more than a war game, in terms of picking through things. But I guess there's kind of too many really good games out there to choose on what would I replace first. That would be a really, really hard thing. You know, these, I guess there's sort of a, something of an idiosyncrasy to what one, you know, sees within a collection that really is really the things that one would if one had to have five, I would really struggle.
Fair enough. Okay, so what's really interesting is that as your greatest hit, you mentioned Root. So you're a history teacher, and I'm not saying there's not a connection, because I actually think there is, but I want to hear your reasoning. Why root in a class that is supposed to be teaching historical subjects? What makes that detour to a fantasy woodland worth it? And how do you connect it back?
So I guess I connect it back, you know, by the root of making the point that the game is an abstraction of something. And I know that Cole has spoken about, you know, how it's a medieval warfare game, with cute little woodland critters, and that allows for the game to do some, as he puts it, fairly mean things, because it's, you know, it's cute and cuddly. I found there's a lot with root in getting students to kind of step away from the trap of trying to follow exactly what happened historically. Some of my students can be like, but that didn't happen, so what do we do now? It's like, well, now you have to roll with it. This is where the game is taking you. This is, you know, but you can use this as an analytical point. If this didn't pan out in reality, so, you know, why, what happened? Was it chance? Did you make a different decision? Is what really happened the result of an unanticipated chance? You know, did someone trip over a log in the forest, and that was kind of it? Root does a really good job of kind of decoupling, what is a methodology of wargaming from necessarily being about a historical subject, that is, you know, then really powerfully you can use with students to say, well, look, here is how this game does it. And it's not trying to tell you something sort of explicit or concrete about history, but you can take ideas from how this is working and the way that it communicates things. And I have said variously with students, it's like, well, so here you are in this woodland space, and you got a series of clearings, and everyone's kind of got different desires and different wind conditions. And then you've got this character who, you know, looks like a raccoon, who can move through the trees. And they're looking at me like, yeah, yes, that's the game we're playing. You know, you've communicated this really well. And you said, well, you know, they've got like spears and things, and they're birds and cats and lizards. I was like, and what if that was Vietnam? And you see the students go, oh, okay. So you said, well, now go play Fire in the Lake. You know, having played Root, which is kind of, you know, in many ways a counterinsurgency game, go play Volko's, you know, go play Fire in the Lake. And they come back and they're like, yeah, I see the crossover here. This is, you know, go play Cuba Libre. Here you have these different factions. And you say, well, so, you know, where does this take you? And I had a design team last fall who, you know, came up with a game about political insurgency and a possible future United States, but decided to abstract it out into deer and coyotes, because they're like, well, we can actually say lots of things without making it be obvious what we're really talking about. And I guess, you know, there's a number of games that do some of that, that work really well in getting students to kind of step away from the, I don't know how to process some of what I'm getting from mechanics and learning because I'm too invested in the historical outcomes. So I guess in kind of trying to teach the design side of things, sort of pulling them out of that historical space then becomes really helpful in being able to get them to sort of think about things in the abstract way, and then to put them back into the historical space of what they're trying to produce a game about.
That makes sense. It makes a lot of sense. So we've talked about kind of the more targeted history and game classes you've done, but you also now do like a war game class that involves a culmination like design project. Do you limit the subject matter? Do students get to just pursue whatever history they want? Or are you teaching a specific history curriculum that also has games alongside it? How do you handle that jump from, you know, this is a game about World War II, I mean, this is a class about World War II with games, to this is a war game class, but it's in this history department?
Yeah, so that was a challenge I thought about quite a lot when I was sort of putting this out there, and you know, being able to, I guess, devise a course that was about the implementation of a methodology rather than the approach towards subject matter. And I stood in front of students, you know, that class one where you kind of always worry that you're going to lay out the stall and tell them what it's all about, and then you're going to leave class and 20 minutes later, you know, any number of them have dropped. Nobody dropped it, so that was good. They all stayed with me. That what I was going to get them to do was they had to be about history, although they could take things into the realms of fantasy as abstractions or science fiction as abstractions. I made the point, these are valid ways of talking about a contemporary world as well as anything else. Really saying that I wasn't going to teach them anything about history. I guess I taught them about the history and development of games, and the history and development of war games. So there was kind of that as a component, but that this wasn't here to be something where they were going to learn about a piece of subject matter. They were here to learn a technique and a methodology in a design space. And I think that was kind of exciting for some of them, because then that meant that they could come up with things that entirely focused on what they wanted, what they were interested in. And I had them in coming up with designs, which I'll be very honest, I kind of shamelessly took this from something that Rex Brynan does, which is I made them make pitches. That we had a couple of weeks in, we had pitch day, where they had to pitch their idea to see if they could generate a design group, to see if there were legs in it. And we got more ideas than ultimately turned into groups. But that led then into, the students were leading what they wanted to do. And we got into things that ranged from, the ancient world and the siege of Syracuse, to the space race, to the emu wars of the early 1930s in Australia, which I learned a lot about. I didn't know very much about that at the time, to looking at American electoral politics in the 1980s, to potential future coyote and deer conflicts in the northern United States, and kind of a range of things in between. I'm probably forgetting that we had end of the Cold War, but I had therefore students who they had ownership over what they were doing. These were their games, not things I pointed at them. I gave them a list of topics they might potentially think about. I'm kind of really sad. No one ever wants to tackle the Russo-Japanese War. Kind of wish they would, because I would like to see how they might do it. And they came up with a range of approaches as well. And they're sort of, saying, well, here's a bunch of supplies and consumables and things, and here's the magic markers, and come up with things. I was kind of fortunate. I have a bunch of students who are computer scientists. And a whole bunch of them produced, amazing things that they were off doing, coding. One of them actually produced an entire digital implementation of their own tabletop game that they actually used that for playtesting. I think they listened to one of my guest experts who talked a lot about playtesting through Tabletop Simulator, and were like, oh, I could figure out how to do this. They're their projects. So while I might give them advice on subjects, I don't necessarily know enough about some of the subject matter that some of them get into to necessarily be all that useful. But, I help them make sure that they're reading enough around a topic and that they're making sure that they're citing their sources when they come up with the design journal. So we know where it came from and how they put it all together. And so, it kind of, it rolls up. I've only taught the design class once. So, you always learn something from teaching something for the first time. So I think it worked well. There are a few things I might tweak in there, but on in general, my students were so exciting to work with, and it was great. It was a room full of engaged students who just went from start to finish and came out with some of which are developing now for publication as prototypes.
So, what will you change about the next go around of the War Game Design class?
So I think, one of the things that I kind of found that they did was not enough playtesting, which I guess is always a challenge. And so I think a few things of trying to get them to have a sort of almost prototype, a playtest, a sort of basically playtest or prototype somewhat earlier in the semester. And I'm getting them to do this in 14 weeks, which is fast. And it's not the only class they take, so there's a lot going on, and I guess trying to give them a bit more space within class time to playtest with each other and playtest each other's games, so that they can kind of get through some of that. Because I think, what we got was games that would benefit from more playtesting and some more space for that. Other than that, I think getting in more external guest speakers into this space. I mean, the great thing about wargaming is how friendly a community it is. I mean, gaming in general, but I'm really sort of more exposed to the wargaming side and how supportive it is, and how willing people, are to come in and talk. And I think I had 5 guest speakers. They were wonderful, all of them. They all had different things to say, but also had some of the same things to say. They had things to contribute that I'm not in such a position to do. I'm a, practicing history professor, not a, professional game designer. Although I'm aware that most of these people also do something else. I might get there with game design at some point. I'm working on things, but I haven't, I'm not David Thompson, who came and spoke to us with 20 something games under my belt and, more on the way seemingly, every year. And so I think exposing them to, people who work within that industry, within that space, and hearing what they do, diversity of approaches, why they choose certain subject matter, what came out of things, what they do. I think, more people, if they want to, come and talk to my students, would give space for that as well. But I think, in general, the class worked really well. The students were really enthusiastic, and I got really good student feedback for it. So, clearly something that students wanted and engaged with.
Fantastic. And what would you say to people who also want to maybe do a war game design class and don't know how to set their students up for success? What did you do right in the class that led to your students being able to create viable projects?
So I think, firstly, there's some really good advice and material out there in space, and there's the Educational Wargaming Collective. There's a lot of Twitter is actually a really good resource as well of talking to things. I think with trying to think about it, the kind of key thing is not letting students spend too much time not getting into the design project, of making sure that they are set up nice and early. The pitch day worked really well because, here we were, and then I said, you must be in groups by the end of week 3. And then I have a series of kind of milestones that they had to meet. So not very long after got them to groups, they had to give a in-class preliminary presentation about what they were thinking and what they were doing. And I created a space for peer feedback in that. And they got precisely a week from when they presented that preliminary design to come back with having thought about it. So it's kind of pushing them quite hard into driving themselves to work in an iterative process. And then we checked in at various points, and then they presented towards the end of the semester. I think, being clear with students about what they need to do by when, because things happen and they decide that they could put things off. You say, well, you're not going to make it to the finish line here with a workable, playable prototype that you can play and demonstrate in class if you haven't got to this point by a certain point. So I think, that is kind of clear. And I could see that in, other examples of people who were doing design stuff. I'm, going to keep referencing Rex and Sebastian, who I think have take similar approaches. I think really, you have to kind of front load things to get students running, and then give them the space to explore stuff and the support and make it clear that you care about what they're doing too, and that you're there to support them and help them develop it, and that also you don't mind if they go off and talk to other people. I think sometimes students are like, is it okay if I go and speak to them? It's like, sure, go. All of the guests said that they were welcome for students to contact them, and I think some of them did. Go use these resources that have come into the classroom in the space and try and work on and develop things.
So this is the question I always have when I'm asking my students to do kind of risky projects. I think the games, especially for students who kind of view school as transactional at times. They want to do the work. They want to be sure that they can get it to the point where it's going to get an A. They know they're going to get assessed. How do you handle the fact that game design is kind of a messy process that can get hung up? It can take a while. You can get stuck. But semesters are time limited. What happens if a student's group starts a game project that gets into the weeds? How do you handle it in a way that's fair to both the creative process and the fact that you have to grade them?
Yeah. Okay. That is a good question. Because you have to give them space to completely fail, and completely mess it up. And you know, many games end up being better because something happened that it broke and it didn't work. So I take an approach, that I guess for its best sort of banner term is specifications grading. So I don't actually end up grading them on anything subjectively. So everything has objectives, you do or you do not. And it is pass fail, and you get the full points for completing a task to the brief. Essentially, in many ways, what this means is that students are, they get to choose the grade they want by how much they invest in the process and the project work. But it starts to, you get so sort of a building block. And so they get, I can't remember the exact breakdown, I have it without looking at my syllabus, but the submission of the final game design, presenting it and playing it through in class, gets them a number of points, probably like 30 or so. And then submitting the design journal gets them another 10 points. And while they do get feedback and subjective feedback, they get the full amount of points for doing the task. And this runs through writing after action reports as well. And to some extent, what this means is that most students end up coming out with an A. If they would just do the bare minimum of things I asked them to do, that I think they get a C. So they pass. I was thinking about this as the creative process of, being able to mitigate the potential for disaster. If it all goes off kilter. I mean, obviously, if a student, if it's a bad faith effort, if they, they turn me in a card, then we might have a conversation about how they didn't actually, perform the task as described. I work with a bunch of very motivated, but yes, transactional is fair. And I guess some of the specifications and points awarding leans into some of that transactionality, but it removes uncertainty in that transaction. They do X, they get Y. And they can see that and they can point things at. What I get back from my students on this is that they really like that approach, because they don't have to worry about what if I hate it, or what if I send it out to a group of people and they go, oh, well, yeah, but you couldn't publish this next Tuesday, or it needs some work, or this, I wouldn't have done it this way. And I think there is a lot of power for students in being able to say, well, look, I did this and maybe it wasn't great, but my grade didn't suffer because it wasn't great. And I did all the things I was supposed to do to get it to there. And, it didn't quite pan out. But I guess what I give them is kind of a safety net. Actually, what I find is that I get really, really good work out of students. And again, kind of surprising thing, I guess, when I started taking this approach in courses of things is that my students end up doing more work than they otherwise would. And they kind of seem to unlock the idea, I guess, sort of, it's almost gamified as an approach, right? They kind of move me through things. And actually, I do in my wargaming class, they earn XP rather than points towards a final grade. And an A is actually is mastery and things. So there's kind of I guess it's a bit like them playing Dungeons and Dragons as they navigate through the dungeon crawl that is wargame design. They come out and they say, this was great. I could see what I needed to do. I did it all. There are things I might have done differently, but there wasn't a lot of space and time. And once we'd embarked on a certain course, we couldn't have turned back. I read feedback from students. It's anonymous, so I have no idea who it is. But they say, I did more work on this than I did on my senior engineering capstone, and I'm going to be a civil engineer. And I'm like, okay, like this was more fun. This was more engaging. They do more research than if I set them papers. So I actually get, you know, while some people might say, well, you know, you're kind of gifting them grades, they're doing the work to earn it. They're doing a lot more work. And it, you know, it's kind of really heartening. I think the students are excited about it, and they can, I've given them the space to fail without it having consequences on their onward life trajectory, which I guess is kind of what playing games is partly about. You know, and in the professional wargaming space, one of the reasons for playing games is to see what goes wrong, and then figure it out and move forwards and play in games. So yeah, no, they're relatively cushioned from disaster, and they do well and they work hard.
That's fair enough. And also, you know, you're putting them in groups. How do you handle group assignments? Are you letting them choose? Always a risk. Are you assigning randomly? Also a risk. I remember, you know, and now that I'm an adult and I like my colleagues, I actually love group work. But I remember in school finding it to be an absolute nightmare. So how do you manage that aspect of your class?
Yeah, the group is always a challenge, right? And always the... You see certain personalities come out in groups of the person who's really organized and effectively appoints themselves as project manager and the person who doesn't do their bit. I let them choose, partly through gravitating together on, you know, ideas together. And some of them, I think, often already know each other from before they get in my classroom. It's a relatively small campus community. And I think the students who take my classes are often students who've taken a bunch of my classes. So, you know, I sometimes joke that they're majoring or minoring in my classes. And so I think I have, you know, groups of students who gravitate together. They often also though seem to gravitate by where they sit, you know, on day one, and then students don't move. But I give them, you know, power to choose their own groups, but I try to set them certain parameters of the fact that they probably don't necessarily want to do this in groups that are bigger than maybe five, because that gets unwieldy. That they might think it's great. We could just, you know, we could be a group of seven and we'll all have to do less work. It's like, that's not how it's going to work. And trying to run a group of seven and getting everyone together is going to be challenging for you. And that they maybe want to think about whether they really want to do this in pairs or whether they want to do this as, you know, three or four. And that, you know, they should think about what excites them, but also what they can, you know, as part of the pitching is, well, here are the skills that I can bring, and here are things I could see within yours that I could do. There is always the risk that if you let students self-select, you end up with the stragglers of the students who don't put their hands up or missed class that day, or weren't really sure, or, you know, are the archetypal sort of loner who doesn't really like group work and would rather work on their own. And you kind of have to gently point them into groups. And I think some of that comes with being able to sort of know who your students are fairly swiftly or over time and say, look, you're not in a group, but this bunch of people are really good. And I think we should go have a chat. So I give them space. I give them time in class to kind of form the groups and do a bit of negotiating with each other. Around the pitches as well. And then, you know, you say, well, I need to know who's in your group so everyone's covered. And I guess part of teaching becomes about managing group dynamics to a certain extent, and checking in with them. Because, you know, if you haven't heard from, you know, John Smith for 3 weeks because he's not answering his emails, you know, maybe I need to intervene and find out what's going on there. And some of that might be that, you know, John Smith is having a really good time playing games and has forgotten about it. But yeah, groups are hard. I guess we get used to groups. I think my students, a lot of them are very used to group work. So, you know, they have some of the dynamic elements figured out. But they're also well aware of what the pitfalls of it can be. So they're kind of on top of it. You know, they all get the same grade within a group. So they're a little cushioned, but they, you know, they push each other as well. I guess it's kind of, once you get into a design, the responsibility to another person kind of counts for most of them.
Nice. All right, I'm going to ask one more big question before going to some soft stuff. So I feel like you've mentioned a few of the benefits of doing gaming as a way for students to access history as opposed to just reading or watching media. They seem to be more engaged, doing more research, thinking about things in a more active way. I guess my thought is, how are you selling this class? I mean, I'm assuming you've made some of these points, but, you know, do you have to do any convincing where you're at, or is your admin bought in? And then also, if people are interested in doing this, but they don't necessarily have a ton of gaming experience, what would you say to those teachers?
Yeah, so I think on the selling it, it's kind of harder to sell it to some of my colleagues than it is to my students often. Because they're like, what, you just play games? It's like, no, they play games and they read stuff. You know, don't worry, this is still serious. This isn't just sort of frivolous. I guess I make the pitch as to what games do and what they teach. But also I think kind of very clearly in 2024, that games offer a kind of experiential learning that right now people are very interested in the idea of experiential learning in lots of fields. And how do you do that in history? Well, it's kind of difficult because unless you can, you know, go live a day as a Roman soldier and everything, which would be great, it can be a little bit challenging. And I guess, you know, the games give the opportunity to put students into the decision space of historical problems. And to think about, you know, representation as a means through the game. So there's a lot there, and yeah, it's hands-on, but it's also cerebral in terms of thinking through things, and I guess less flat than yelling at a screen, that's not what that uniform looked like, or that could never have happened. You know, all of these things to why I'm terrible to watch historical movies with. Or, you know, reading a book where maybe, you know, some academic history books can be really hard to read. It can be a really sort of heavy going. And I guess games give an outlet there. And I think my colleagues have become pretty convinced of that. And I've presented at the American Historical Association, you know, on the use of games as well. It's kind of clear that there is more of this happening kind of every day. I guess in terms of people who don't have lots of gaming experience, I guess that is a challenge. I think a lot of people are, these games are really complicated, or they're really difficult, or isn't that Dungeons and Dragons, and I'm not that kind of person. I guess, you know, there is a sort of, or coupled to that, an idea that play isn't something that adults do, because that's what children do. And you go, well, look, you know, actually, no, this is fairly serious, and these are serious topics, and these are serious games. But also, it could be fun. You could just be set collecting birds if you want to play Wingspan. I think with kind of, how do I get it? How do I get gaming experience? There's so much material out there that I think is really useful. There's your podcast, which is, you know, I think makes a really good case for games and the people you have on and what they have to say. But also, I think gives, you know, people information about things. There are other podcasts, you know, out there that, you know, are there to help people. There's a really helpful community who will give advice on things. But I guess in terms of gaming experience, I think, you know, seek out other people who have game, who play games, or who, you know, will talk about them, because there's lots of people out there who are really supportive, and, you know, find ways to teach things. Some of the digital formats can be really useful in that way, because they often have tutorials that take you through. There are YouTube channels out there that will help you play things. But I think also, you know, part of it becomes sort of the game discovery of, what do I want to do with this game, and what would I think about? And, you know, what does this one do sort of that something else doesn't do, and how do I use this? Crucially, is this going to work for my students? Is this going to work for me? I guess I teach things where there's lots of games in the subject matter. It would be far harder to perhaps, you know, think about more minor conflicts, the world wars, there's sort of any number of things. But I think there's also, you know, there's good resources like Board Game Geek, you know, love it or hate it. There's lots of material out there that helps inform things. And then I guess finding partners to play things with, and playing things with your students is not a bad idea, even if they're not in your course. I have a, you know, what sits alongside my teaching is what I call the Wargaming Lab. And I'm advisor to the University Gaming Society. Going and playing games and getting experience of things is just a really good way in. And I guess, you know, everyone is new at something at some point. So there's lots of sort of, you know, ways of moving into things. And, you know, I think also you can learn that alongside your students. You don't need to be the most experienced gamer to say, look, here's something I want to explore with you too.
I like it. But you, being a gamer, we'll go into the soft questions. What have you been playing recently that brings you joy?
What have I been playing? Well, I've been playing Root recently, again, with my children, actually, because, you know, they kind of like the idea. I've moved through various things of late. I went through Versailles 1919 because I was going to use it in class to teach. So I played through it. I've been playing Atlantic Chase quite a lot because I'm kind of fascinated by the mechanic of thinking about these trajectories and where things go. Yeah, I'm trying to think about what else has been pulled off my shelves of late. I played through Pax Pamir recently.
That's such a good game.
Such a beautiful game. You know, trying to sort of unpick things, and partly because there are elements there that get me to think about some of the things that I write about in my own work. And I think I also recently I played through Meltwater again. Trying to get my teenage son in the wake of Oppenheimer to think about the implications of nuclear bombs and nuclear warfare. So I guess kind of diverse and varied things. In sort of the thick of teaching, I don't necessarily get through as much as I might. But, you know, there's lots of things I keep meaning to, you know, pull out and set things up, and I don't quite get to it. But I guess I return to things that I sort of know well, and then think about, well, I really should get into this one. So I've got things sort of in my queue. I'm looking forward to getting into Chad Jensen's Into Downfall, which is sitting on my shelves, and to kind of go back to certain things sort of with different perspectives. I play quite a lot of the coin games, partly because you can play many of those on your own. Which makes things, you know, convenient, and in the mechanic is appealing there, and I'm kind of figuring through a design idea I have that kind of fits with that as a set of mechanics. So, I've been playing through those quite a bit, partly to unpick how they work and how I can move them into my own ideas.
Excellent. And then for people who want to follow you and your work and maybe an upcoming design, oh my goodness, online, where can you be found?
So I'm on Twitter or X, whatever we are not calling it now, as A Coach O Wee. It's not the greatest of things. It's probably the easiest public forum to find me, but I'm Googleable. I'm a history professor at a university, so I have a public profile. So if you type my name in, you will find me and find an email address and contact details there. So, you know, by all means, do send me emails or contact me on Twitter. You know, I think those are sort of the two easiest avenues, and, you know, either of those works for me.
Fantastic. I, of course, can be found anywhere as Beyond Solitaire. But Allie, thank you so much for coming on. This has been a delightful conversation, and your students are very lucky people.
Thank you.
And for everybody out there, please like, subscribe, comment, ask questions, and most of all, happy gaming.